Chapter 6. So far, I had no means of controlling our progress. I thought, anyway, that it was vital to keep track of our position. To do this, it was necessary to devise a way to gauge, as accurately as possible, the speed of our craft. The only navigation instrument I had was a small aerial navigator's scale of mileage. This was handy, and of course I had a thorough knowledge of the heavenly bodies used in navigation. I tried several schemes for estimating our speed. One of the first was to throw a piece of rag, which was the only thing we had that would float, into the water, then counting by the 1001-1002 method, it taking just about a second to say each numeral. While we still had plenty of rags, I would tear a few threads and cast them into the water, as far ahead as I could, then count as they passed the length of the raft, which was the known factor. Thus, I came to deduce that an estimated 12 knots of wind gave us a drift of approximately 2.5 knots, 6 knots of wind, a drift of 1 knot. However, I did not find the thread method very satisfactory. In the tool pocket, there was also a 20-foot length of heavy cord. I cut off a length of about 6 feet of this, and tied to the end a flat metal identification disc from Tony's key ring to act as a sinker. I tied the other end of the line to the center of the side of the raft and tossed it out to drift. The metal disc was slightly concave and would flutter as we scooted along. The faster we went, the faster it would flutter, and the nearer the surface it would rise. I soon became quite expert at computing our speed with fair accuracy by this means. I figured that if I could estimate our speed and direction within a 10% error, we would at least not become entirely lost in the time it would take us to starve to death or be overtaken by disaster from one of the other ever-present hazards we were facing daily. At the very first, we decided to keep a continuous watch, and we did throughout the first few weeks, up until the time we became too weak and exhausted to sit up for any length of time. We had no timepiece, of course, but each of us would stand what we judged to be 4 hours at the start. After about a week, I cut this to 2 hours. Naturally, our minds began to dull, and our faculties for judgment became less and less dependable, so there developed considerable reneging on the watch time. Once I stood watch practically all day by myself in the blazing sun, and after that I laid down the law in no uncertain terms. The watches worked out more satisfactorily after that. Discipline was well kept throughout the voyage. Naturally, I was in command. I took an occasion to remind the boys that I, as captain, held absolute authority. "We've got to be all for one and one for all," I explained. "But when a final decision has to be made by one of us for all of us, the captain's word has got to be the law." Tony and Jean, good sailors both, readily assented, and we had no trouble on that score. As time went on, though, our dispositions became rottener and rottener. I, being older and more experienced, blame myself more than either of the others for the times toward the last when my temper got out of control. There were occasions, I'm ashamed to admit, when my greatest exasperation was over the fact that I had nothing in the boat to throw. On the whole, though, we managed to get along very well, and even had some pleasant times, with such little diversions as we could invent. The boys were both pretty much afraid at first that our boat would soon spring a leak and sink. Without the air pump, which was lost with the plane, we had no means whatever of keeping up the air pressure if any leak developed. I'll admit that I was none too happy about this situation at times. I kept warning the boys to be careful about fraying or inadvertently snagging the fabric with any sharp metal or the buttons on their clothes. It was all important that we show the greatest possible care for the sides of the air compartments of our boat. So we were as cautious as we could be, knowing it would be much easier to maintain the boat in its present excellent condition than to try to recondition it should we puncture the sides through careless maneuvering. To this end, I found it necessary to repeat frequently my warnings of the danger attendant from shirt and trouser buttons, careless handling of gear, and even quick and incautious moving of our persons, which would cause unnecessary scuffing or wearing of the fabric. Occasionally, I would dig in the tool pocket for the small bottle of rubber cement and touch up any frayed spots where it looked as if the fabric might be weakening in the vicinity. This treatment not only retarded the fraying action on those parts, but showed us the spots that were most vulnerable to wear owing to our moving about in the boat. As time went on and our gallant little rubberized fabric boat showed no signs of serious wear or deterioration of any kind, I soon acquired the greatest of confidence in her. She rode the waves like a veteran ocean-going steamer. The only time she would take water to any important amount was when a big comber broke directly into the boat. Then about 5 to 10 gallons of white water would pour down on us from the break of the crest. That always meant a good soaking of everything in the boat, including us, and a job of bailing out again. The bailing we accomplished by taking off our clothes, sopping up the water with them and wringing them out over the side, then wringing out our clothes again before putting them back on. When the wind had held steadily in one direction for a period of a few hours, all the swells and surface waves would run in the same direction, quite evenly and with a steady motion. Every sixth or seventh wave would be the big one that broke. After that, everything would die down to a lull, then start building up to another breaker. These gave us very little trouble until the wind got up to around 20 knots and the breakers became heavy. But just after a shift of wind, it would be a different story. The big swells would run with the former wind direction, but the surface waves, being wind-formed, would now be going in a new direction. When these opposing forces met, there was terrifying commotion which resulted in many nasty drenchings. When off watch and lying in the bottom of the boat trying to get some rest, it would be more than annoying to get a face full of cold and heavy salt water thrown with the force of a bludgeon. Because of this, and also because of the smaller waves which were continually punching at the thin cover of fabric that formed our bottom, it was impossible to get anything approaching rest except during the latter hours of a protracted dead calm, when all surface waves had died down. These periods were rare and gave us other things to worry about. The second day we had time to appreciate the dawn. When the big tropical sun ball peeked over the gray horizon, our dismal world became instantly beautiful, and our drooping spirits never failed to lift. Tony would sing out, "Time to put on the pot," and Jean and I never lost a second in searching with our eyes the farthest blue and gold reaches of our suddenly expanded ken. It was at dawning that we stretched our stiffened muscles and worked warm new life into numb and aching members. It was always then that our spirits were at their highest, for each new day brought new hope and new variation to relieve the long monotony of the cheerless night. This good humor usually lasted until the friendly sun shortly turned into a malevolent brass ball of heat that baked us pitilessly inside our wet clothes like fish wrapped in leaves to broil. At about noon this second day, we could stand it no longer without taking the last measure for relief that was left. We stripped then, and one at a time slipped into the water, holding the side of the boat. Each of us stayed in about 5 minutes, dunking up and down. It made us feel so much better that we then decided to keep deliberately wet during the heat of the day, flicking water on each other. We had our swim in quite gingerly fashion, losing no time hopping back into the boat, for there were a lot of sharks around. We talked this over, and finally I vetoed the idea of any more swimming. Sharks were always near the boat. Most of them were small, it is true, but they were always in evidence, and I could never be sure that a large one was not somewhere about. I've heard many arguments pro and con as to whether a shark would attack a human being in the water, but I did not feel that we should take chances. Later, we were to get mighty convincing evidence in several instances that they are dynamite and not to be trifled with.